Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They say that war is hell, and no one denies it. But with 120-degree heat, widespread civil unrest, and increasing attacks on U.S. troops, it now appears that occupation may be hell, too. Tonight on Point, we'll hear from young Marines sent to carry out U.S. policy in Iraq, just back from the war and the difficult occupation in its wake. Began in Washington, where the White House is making a major organizational change in the efforts to manage Iraq. Frustrated by slow progress and setbacks, the administration has created the Iraq Stabilization Group, which will be run by National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. The move is seen as a shift of responsibilities from the Pentagon to the White House itself. David Sanger is White House correspondent for the New York Times. I asked him if the Bush administration is embracing this view of the change.
Well, only partly. They maintain that there is no effort here to subvert the authority of the Defense Department, which takes the lead. And, of course, Paul Bremer, who's the coalition provisional authority or the leader of that, reports still to the Pentagon. But, you know, in Washington, the way things look on the flow charts and the way power actually moves can be two very different things. And so look at what they've done here. They have basically said that the major problems that we're facing in Iraq right now, with the exception of counterterrorism, are not military or law enforcement problems. They're economic problems, they're media problems, they're problems of getting the utilities on and so forth. They require coordination in different parts of the government. And who's better to do that than the people who sit at the pinnacle of the government in the White House? So the coordinating committees for this are going to be run out of the White House with deputies to Condoleezza Rice, who's the National Security Advisor. What that means, in effect, though, is that the major decisions on these issues will have to all come before those coordinating committees, because if they don't, they can't get coordinated. So the decision-making power, while it may look on paper to still be in the Pentagon, is most likely in practice to be at the White House.
David, does the White House have, many words we could use, but a simple one, time? Do they have the time to coordinate all of these efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan? It looks like a big piece of business.
It does look like a big piece of business, but I think the way that to turn that question around, Tom, is to say, do they have the political leeway to afford not to do it? In other words, the system that's working right now, by all accounts, isn't working. Decisions are taking too long. Responses are uncoordinated. The poll ratings for the president's handling of this have been dropping fairly rapidly, and election season is upon us. They realize that they're about to go get $87 billion, or however much Congress ultimately gives them, and that money is going to have to be spent well, because if the spending of that money turned out not to be effective, then they've got those problems on top of the problems that they've had so far.
So the way this will work with this new Iraq Stabilization Group is issues will come up through the directly deployed departments, i.e. the Pentagon, let's say, and come all the way up to Condoleezza Rice sitting in the White House for her to vote yay or nay on a particular policy?
They will come up to four subcommittees that are run all by fairly close deputies of hers. There's one in the economy that's going to be run by the fellow who for years has been doing the interaction between the National Economic Council and the National Security Council. The counterterrorism issues are going to come in front of her deputy for counterterrorism and so on. I presume that they will handle everything that they can handle, and that the only things that will go to Dr. Rice and to Steve Hadley, who's the deputy National Security Advisor, will be those questions that can't get handled at that level.
Is there a precedent for this, David? Have wars or post-war periods been run this way before?
Well, there was a Presidential Decision Directive 56 in the Clinton administration, which tried to get interagency response together on some past peacekeeping operations we've done. There have been various crisis committees. The Reagan administration had one. The Carter administration had one for various problems that have come up. obviously not involving anything like the Iraq situation. But whenever the going gets tough, somebody usually says, let's centralize it in the White House. Now, for this president, it's an interesting instinct because, remember, when he came in 2.5 years ago, this seems like a long time ago, Tom, he was announcing that he was the first president with an MBA, mm-hmm. and he knew that what you had to do was push authority down to the departments. Remember that, you know, Health and Human Services and Energy and...
Delegate, just like a CEO.
Delegated down to where decisions could be made. Mm-hmm. And I think people in Washington will tell you this is probably already, even before today's announcement, the most centralized White House power structure that anybody can remember in recent times.
So forget about the delegation. And you write that this move to reorganize the flowchart around Iraq came out of a meeting that Condoleezza Rice and Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and Don Rumsfeld had at President Bush's ranch in August. That must not have been a pretty meeting.
There was Condoleezza Rice and the President at his ranch in late August, and they came back and had a meeting, the NSC, I think the next week when they were back there.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure there have been a series of unpleasant meetings. Now, there's an interesting counter theory that is being spun out here, and maybe it's being spun for my benefit. That happens on rare occasion. That Secretary Rumsfeld is perfectly happy to have this stuff moved off his plate because he's been taking the heat for things that haven't been going well and that he believes the Pentagon doesn't do well. You know, he's the man who said early on, we don't do nation building with the military. The president said that too.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to look at this is that he's saying, great, this monkey's off my back. I can go worry about Iran, North Korea, other rogue states, and the military operations in Iraq. And you guys can go handle the rest of this stuff.
But it does mean that the president carries accountability for what happens in Iraq even more clearly, as if it weren't clear enough already, ultimately, into next year's election.
You'll see a senior administration official quoted who says, this moves the accountability on Iraq right into the White House.
And there it stands. David Sanger, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
David Sanger is White House correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Washington. The confrontation in Iraq grinds on, and attacks on U.S. troops have increased in the past few weeks. 313 U.S. troops have now been killed in Iraq, more than half of those since the end of what President Bush called major combat operations. U.S. combat troops have had to adapt to new jobs that were not the focus of their training. Marines and Army troops have had a crash course in riot control, policing, and even civil administration. And they are working without a net in the desert heat, under duress, and sometimes under fire. The details of their daily lives have been slow to reach the home front. But tonight, we're going to hear from two Marines recently returned from Iraq, from the war, from the occupation. What do you want to know from U.S. Marines just back from Iraq? From the guys assigned to patrol the streets and bust down the doors, what's your question for the young men on the get-it-done end of U.S. policy in Iraq? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio are Corporal Zach Johnson and Lance Corporal Jeremy Villanueva of the U.S. Marine Corps, 1st Marine Division. The two returned home from Baghdad last week, safe and sound, after an 8-month tour in Iraq. Zach Johnson is 22 years old and a native of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Corporal Zach Johnson.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for being here. And Jeremy Villanueva is 21 years old, married, and from Bakersfield, California. Lance Corporal Jeremy Villanueva, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
There's so much we want to hear from both of you. 8 months is a long, long time. Just for starters, it means, of course, that you were there well before the occupation. You were there for the invasion. Zach Johnson, take us in. Where did your time in Iraq begin, and where were you when the invasion began?
Well, we were in Kuwait for about 3 years before we actually...
3 years?
3 weeks.
Okay, it felt like 3 years.
But we were there for about 3 weeks waiting and doing what we could to make the last-minute preparations. Mm-hmm. Then on March 21st, as the invasion kicked off, that morning was when we actually crossed the border, started our move towards Baghdad.
So we all saw the arrows that went snaking up from Kuwait toward Baghdad. Jeremy Villanueva, which arrow were you on?
It's still kind of, you know, I'm still not really quite sure, you know, because we were just there. We went where
did
they
you go right up the rivers? Were you on the western flank, on the eastern flank, with the 1st Marine?
You know, I don't really know which flank that we were on. All I know that it was really dusty the whole way through.
And what kind of vehicles were you all in?
We were in AAVs, which is amphibious armored vehicles. And those are the vehicles that we took in. So,
okay. And, you know. And how many men would be in each vehicle?
It would be half a platoon. So it would be about...
We had about 18 in ours,
yeah,
plus the crew.
18 in the vehicle. And were you two, Zach and Jeremy, together throughout your entire 8 months in Iraq? You're always part of the same unit.
Yes.
So, Zach, what was that like, the advance up? It was, only took 3 weeks or something like that, but give us a sense of what it was. Was it a steady progression? Was it move, stop, fight, move? What was it like?
I'd say it's more like the latter. I mean, we consistently stayed moving. We're never in the same place for more than a day or so. But, I mean, it was obviously a very confused time. They did what they could to keep us up to date, but, you know, they're telling you the names of these towns that you don't really recognize.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of going. So there's a lot of long hours riding in the vehicle. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get the call, there's someone's taking fire, and you got to go clear a building or, you know, do some sort of operation. So it's a lot of waiting for, you know, a few very exciting minutes and then to waiting.
And Jeremy, were you in the chem bio suits the whole time? Was the threat of chemical or biological attack always there or just at certain points?
Well, up for most of the war, up until like right before we went into Baghdad, we had what we call MOP suits, which is our chem bio suits. And they were really hot, and we did wear them throughout almost the entire time. We did have some chemical warnings where we had to put on, you know, our gas masks, and we had to wear our little boots sometimes and our little gloves. And it was really, sometimes it'd be really awkward trying to do it with a jam-packed, AAV, because there's not much room in the back of there. And a bunch of guys, you know, all sweaty and stinky trying to, you know, throw
get
on these
big
like,
suits on.
Yeah, get, well, the suits were always on, but like trying to throw on
the mask and the boots.
And, you know, you're like kicking some guy in the face when you're trying to put on your boots and everything. And it was quite a funny situation that we had going there.
Was it for each of you, you're 21 and 22 years old, was it for each of you your first time in active combat?
Yes.
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 And what surprised you about it, Zach?
I mean, obviously, as someone in the infantry, you know, it's something that you go in, you know, accepting you may have to do. So you do your best to, you know, kind of prepare yourself, you know, and you spend years training for it. But, I mean, you still have to accept that once you're in there, I mean, it's a totally different world. You know, there's really nothing you can do to be totally prepared for it.
Most of our listeners will not have experienced that world. What do you mean when you say a totally different world? In the way that it's just completely pedal to the metal. You do whatever you have to do. You're obviously in very aggressive attack mode heading for Baghdad.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and like I said, it was something different, you know. But what I found a lot is when we're actually going out and we're doing these missions and we're clearing these objectives is that you really just it's kind of a cliche. We do fall back on the training. I mean, I was surprised. I'm doing it, you know, and it's for real, and the bullets are going both ways, you know, and you're seeing them shooting at you and hearing the bullets come by your head, but still
But it's been drummed into you, drilled into you. This is what you do.
Exactly. I mean, you just kind of go sort of on instinct again, something of a cliche, but it really, really did seem to hold true.
And when the major combat operations ended, when Baghdad fell, where were you, Jeremy? Where was your unit?
When the major combat operations ceased, we were actually in Saddam City.
In eastern Baghdad.
Yes.
It's like a suburb.
Yeah,
of Baghdad.
Yeah. It's one of the suburbs.
A Shiite area, right?
Yes. Yes. Heavily Shiite. And and we were actually going through, at the time that they probably said that, then we were most likely getting mobbed by a bunch of grateful Iraqis screaming, you know, good mister, good bush, you know, what is your name? And yeah, we were. You know, it was just another one of the days, really. I mean, I can't really remember the exact day that it was, you know, when end of hostilities, you know, happened.
But you know that at that time you were in Saddam City, eastern Baghdad, and being mobbed by fairly grateful people at that point.
Yes.
But then it turned into a long occupation, maybe longer than either of you expected.
I think definitely longer than we were expecting, but I mean, it's not really, you don't really want to go into that saying, okay, I'm going to be here for a long time. You're just kind of hoping, well, do this and maybe then it'll be over, and maybe it'll be over, but it dragged out, but you know, I think.
And it's still dragging out. We really want to hear about this occupation experience because, of course, that's the challenge right now. We have to take a short break. We're going to come back and get the details from you. We're talking tonight with two U.S. Marines just back from Iraq about life inside the U.S. occupation. You can join this conversation. What do you want to know from U.S. troops just back from the front, from the guys who have had to patrol the streets and bust down the doors? What information are you missing about the soldier's eye view of the war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with two U.S. Marines just back from Iraq about life inside the U.S. occupation, about what they saw, what they did, what they know that we ought to know. Our guests tonight are Zachary Johnson. He's a corporal in the U.S. Marine Corps, 1st Marine Division, 22 years old, from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. And from Bakersfield, California, 21 years old, Jeremy Villanueva, Lance Corporal in the U.S. Marine Corps. Both got back in the States last week and are sitting with us here tonight. You can join this conversation as well. What information are you missing about the soldier's eye view of the war? What's your question for the young men carrying out U.S. policy in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeremy Villanueva, let's get straight to the occupation, because you spent many, many months longer working on the occupation than you did in the actual hot invasion. We've heard so many stories about it. We all watch these death tolls each week, and it's terrifying, and everybody feels that, my gosh, you know, to be in the boots that you were in just days ago, rough and scary. But we don't really know what the experience is like in any firsthand way. For you, we'll get to the details, but overall, what was the hardest thing about being part of the U.S. occupation force in Iraq?
I'd have to say that, you know, I had a wife and a kid. I have a son. Mm-hmm. And being away from them, you know, never knowing definitely what was going to happen. Most of the Iraqis really were appreciative of seeing us there all the way until the day that we left. You know, they loved us being there, and you know, they really didn't want to see us go. But yeah, I'd say that the hardest thing was just being away from home, you know.
We can sure understand that, and not knowing exactly when you'll get home. Zachary,
yeah.
Johnson, everyone has to share that feeling. But what about right on the ground there, in your interaction with Iraqis? What was easy? What was hard?
Well, there's definitely some major cultural barriers, you know. I mean, kind of to accept that we don't really understand each other, but we're trying to work together. And for a month and a half while we were there, we actually lived in a police station working directly with local Iraqi police. So, I mean, during that time, you know, it really gave us a good opportunity, our first opportunity to really get to kind of know Iraqis personally.
Mm-hmm.
And so learned to work.
That was Iraqi, newly recruited Iraqi policeman.
Most of these guys had actually been around for a while. I mean, it was pretty much immediately after the war, so they really had an opportunity to get new police yet. So we were working with them, you know, and our job was pretty much to back them up. They were the ones that, you know, chose what we were going to do, pretty much, the ones who were going out to make the arrests and stuff like that. And in a way, you know, we kind of adapt and accept, you know, the way they worked there. And then also they kind of had to sort of learn, you know, the new way, the post-bath party, what was acceptable and what wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were plopped down into different situations during this occupation period. During mm-hmm. that first part in Saddam City, part of the outskirts of Baghdad, you were living in a cigarette factory for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't sound the greatest, but better than living in a trench in the desert, I guess. And then you were moved to Al-Hila near Babylon, and you were in another factory there. What kind of factory was that?
Well, it was really a date warehouse.
A warehouse for processing dates from
yes.
date trees.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so was there fruit there? I mean, was that part of the picture?
There was a little. I mean, it was pretty empty. I don't know, maybe it wasn't date season when we got there. You know, we reached an arrangement with the people who owned it, so, I mean, then they kind of stopped harvesting dates and, you know, lived off the income we provided them while we were there.
What was your daily routine? We read about the patrols, you know, inside and outside the so-called Sunni Triangle. This was outside the Sunni Triangle, right? Or I mean, was this in the hottest part of Iraq where most of the attacks were taking place?
Well, there was a major difference. Like where we were, it was actually fairly quiet for the most time. We did not really get attacked with any real frequency. I mean, it's a pretty rare event where it's just half an hour down the road. Yes, they were experiencing mm-hmm. attacks almost daily.
So you were close to it, but it wasn't right on your doorstep all the time.
No. But, I mean, it's a possibility you always had to live with. You know, I mean, they did happen, even if they were rare. Every time you had to go out, You know, even if you know something's probably not going to be happening, you have to be ready for it, absolutely.
And Jeremy Villanueva, what about your efforts in your unit to track down resistance groups, people who had weapons they shouldn't have? Was that something? Was that every day? Was that sometimes?
Was it every night?
Oh,
it was definitely one of the things that we did. There was a lot of times where we went out and, you know, went to go get the bad guys. And, you know, most times with a lot of success, you know, we'd go out and go find who we were looking for, and we'd capture them. Sometimes we'd find weapons with them, and then we'd, you know, send them to the court system, you know, so that, you know, legal system can take care of them. But we were, you know, helping the police out mostly because this was usually the Iraqi police job, just they needed a little bit of help with it. And we were usually the ones going out with them and helping them out.
Would you be the most heavily armed, the most heavily armored, or would they also be fully armed, the Iraqi police that you worked with?
They had their own weapons. They had their AKs and whatnot. And we had the same stuff. We weren't as heavily armed as we were during the war, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But we went out there with, you know, our body armor and our helmets and, you know, our M16s and, you know, whatever weapons that we had. And we'd go out and help them.
And Zach Johnson, how did that, what was your success rate there? Who came up with the information about where to go? We're reading, you know, that intelligence is a real problem in Iraq. The front page of the Wall Street Journal today, big story saying, hey, the generals complain they just don't know where to send the troops sometimes. In your case, you worked with Iraqi police, but they were former policemen in the Ba'ath era as well. They would bring you the information. You'd go out daytime or nighttime, knock down the door, and usually looking for guns or what?
Well, usually when we go out, I mean, there are really two types of operations. There are the ones where we go out and work directly with the police, you know, and that was what they felt the priorities were, you know, where they need to be to maintain the peace. And then also we would do our own operations based off our own intelligence that we get coming to us, and those would be like the raids where we go out usually in the middle of the night to arrest former high-ranking Ba'ath Party members.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. And again, unfortunately, you know, I don't really work in the intelligence field. By the time of the operation, someone else comes up with the operation and then tells where to go and when.
But you were on the execution end of it. Did you feel like you were getting pretty good intelligence? Did you come up with a lot of dry holes? What, you know, what was the kind of success rate that you were having?
It's hard to say exactly. I mean, we go out, we grab them, and then, you know, we pass them on.
Mm-hmm. And really, someone else had to decide if you got the right guys or if it was the right place.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and someone who listens in the news, which unfortunately we didn't really have access to, mm-hmm. over there, mm-hmm. we could probably tell you more accurately what our success rate is than we could.
And when you'd go out in the night and you'd knock the door down, I mean, obviously that's a dangerous moment. But you're also going into a circumstance you don't know if it's, you know, all armed and ready to respond to, or if it's very civilian and family sleeping there. You know, what do you remember, Jeremy, from those, how often were you, you know, busting into someone's bedroom with a wife and kids asleep there as well? Or how often would it look like, hey, this is all business, this is all guns and...
It was, for the most part, I'd say that, you know, a lot of times knocking on the door, yielded just as much results. We were very flexible. I mean, we'd give them a lot of chances. There was, you know, only a few times where we actually busted in, there was like any children there sleeping or anything. It was you know, usually the people, they knew that, you know, what they were doing, and they knew that they were, you know, doing something bad, and so they usually, you know, they weren't ready to respond.
They'd come with you, in other words. You'd come to the door at night,
like,
say, hey, this is it, and they'd come.
Yeah, and they'd be like, okay, you know, we know that you're coming to get us, so we're going to go with you now. Yeah, there was a few times where the people, you know, tried to play innocent, but for the most part, when they were outnumbered, they really didn't want to put up much resistance, especially not to... heavily armed Marines.
Yeah. We're talking tonight with two U.S. Marines just back from Iraq about life inside the U.S. occupation. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are Corporal Zachary Johnson, 22 years old, from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, and Jeremy Villanueva, 21 years old, from Bakersfield, California, Lance Corporal in the U.S. Marine Corps. Peter's calling from Boston. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Good evening. First, my congratulations to these two fine young Marines. I'm a former Marine Corps veteran, 1st Marines, 0311 type, which they probably know what that means, combat veteran from Vietnam.
Okay.
First question I'd like to ask you guys, how did they deal with the engagement when the people were having weapons in their hands? when they, you know, with the, you know, how did they address that issue? Were they, did they find this restrained? And as I can, in Vietnam, anytime we saw a VC or NVA with a weapon, we shot them dead. I was wondering how those guys dealt with that.
Peter, may I ask you on that front, do you mean when they were driving toward Baghdad or afterward in the occupation months?
I tell you, anytime I was in Vietnam, January 68 till February 69,
yeah.
Anytime you saw a Vietnamese with an AK-47 walking around in the jungle, you shot him first. Mm-hmm. You never asked questions. Mm-hmm. They weren't surrendering. But I was just asking how the rules of engagement was with that when they were engaged in combat. Secondly, what was the percentage of married guys in the, I assume it's a grunt outfit, what the percentage? We had probably less than 10%. What was the percentage of married guys? Thirdly, how many of these guys are thinking of shipping over and back in combat arms?
Oh, let us pick them up. And the tough one comes first. But what about the rules of engagement? When someone in occupation Iraq is carrying arms and you're out on duty, well, what was it? Peter said in Vietnam it was shoot first and ask later. How about Iraq?
Well, I can't really, unfortunately, get into the specific rules of engagement. And they did vary quite a bit between, you know, in the war it could vary from town to town, and then after the war it really depended on the situation. I mean, I think about all I can really say on that is we always definitely felt like, you know, we were flexible enough that we could defend ourselves. We never felt like we were in a situation where we had to, where we didn't have, you know, the flexibility we needed to be able to respond appropriately.
So you didn't feel unduly exposed through your rules of engagement? You didn't feel so constrained that your life was put in extra danger?
Absolutely not.
But it also sounds like you're saying something slightly different than what you're hearing from Peter in Vietnam.
Well, I mean, again, unfortunately, I think with the current ongoing situation, well, now we can't really get into what our specific rules of engagement were. You know, we don't really want them knowing what our criteria were because, you know, then you might have Iraqis trying to toe the line.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. And two other questions there. First, Jeremy, you're married, but what about
Yes.
the percentage of guys in your unit, in your, you know, in your company who mm-hmm. were married? How common was it?
Well, you got to understand most of these kids are, you know, most of us guys are, you know, like fresh out of high school and everything, you know, and they come a lot of times and they join the Marine Corps and they go all the way to California, you know, away from their, you know, high school girlfriends and whatnot. And they don't, you know, they don't.
You're saying there's not time to get married for most people?
Right, right.
You were quick off the mark, but not everybody was as quick as
well,
you.
Well, actually, you know, I've been in the Marine Corps for a little over 3 years now. And, you know, I did, you know, wait a little while before I got married.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, a lot of guys, there's a few of them that, especially, you know, our senior guys, you know, higher up the ranks,
right.
Of course, there's more of them that are married. But
a pretty small percentage overall.
Right. In the E4 and below, it's pretty small, yeah.
And the issue of going back, you all just spent 8 months in Iraq. That's some pretty serious duty. Are you going to be turned around and set right back? It's the kind of thing we hear these days. Do you know what your future holds in terms of deployment?
It's hard to say, really. I mean, for what it's worth, we were gone 8 months. Only 5 of those months were actually spent in Iraq. Being with the war and then the mm-hmm. occupation.
Mm-hmm.
I think the feeling is, you know, the Marine Corps is tailored, you know, as an expeditionary force, you know, sort of a quick reaction type thing, like they say the world's a 911. So I think the Marine Corps in general is going to try and avoid getting too much involved in the occupational duties because we, like our unit, has other obligations. We have to put out Marine expeditionary units and whatnot. So in order to
You're not expecting to go back to Iraq, at least not anytime soon.
Well, I mean, again, I don't make that policy, unfortunately, so.
But you must have some expectation. Some idea, or not?
I honestly couldn't tell you. I mean, like I said, unfortunately, I'm not as up to date with the news and the politics of everything as pretty much everyone in the U.S. So,
even though you're just back, you feel like it could happen. You could be sent over again.
We're not planning on it. I mean, I can say that much. There's mm-hmm. certainly not any date or any plans in place for us to go back there.
Damien's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Damien. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Good evening. First off, just welcome back to America, and thank you to both of you. Someone who didn't serve and went to college and said, I appreciate what you guys do for this country. My question is, I'm just curious as to what kind of training the Marine Corps offered you guys in dealing with Iraqis and dealing with Arab culture, seeing as you were part of an occupation force, but you dealt a lot with police and with, you know, the people of Iraq, and what kind of training, either language or culturally, you received to do that.
It's a great question, Damien. Let us pick it up. Jeremy, how much? Did you have a phrase book? Did you have Iraqi words and phrases and sentences that you became fluent in? How much training did you get? Was there cultural training? Here's how Iraqis see this or that kind of behavior? Mm-hmm. Or did you pretty much go in cold?
Well, we definitely didn't go in cold. That's one thing I can say is that we usually never went in cold into, you know, anything. And, yeah, we did actually have a phrase book. We talked a lot with the guys who are, you know, our senior guys, you know, people that are higher up in the ranks who are actually served in the first, you know, Persian Gulf War. And they taught us a lot about what they saw. And we listened to, they would tell us a bunch of stuff like, you know, some things that just in the Arabic culture, you know, in the Muslim culture that these people didn't like, you know, having, you know, to do to them. So we were trying.
Can you give us an example or two?
There was one thing that, you know, it's a big insult with to do with like, don't ever like, you know, try to show them your feet, you mm-hmm. know, don't ever like, you know, go,
get them involved with your shoes.
Right. You know, mm-hmm. don't like, you know, if you're going to, you know, like just do something with your shoes and throw it out the window and hit some one of them. That's a really big insult, you know, is hitting mm-hmm. someone with like your shoes or your sandals mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, but a lot of it, too, when we were actually occupying, a lot of our translators that went and worked with us, they would come over and they'd talk to us about, you know, what how their life was and, you know, what
these would be Iraqi civilians.
Right, right. And they'd come and they that you know, worked for us, and they'd come and we'd talk with them, you know, got to be good friends with some of them, actually. And they'd tell us, you know, about their cultural stuff, and we'd get, you know, talk to them. And that's how we learned most of it, you know.
And Zach, it's I think endlessly fascinating with that cultural interaction. You know, how often was it? Every day or every now and then? Where you just look at what was going on and say, I do not get what's happening here. This is outside my cultural experience.
It's definitely an amazingly different culture. I mean, it's really just a totally different world from what we have here. All the sights, the smells, the sounds is totally different over there. You know, so I mean, we often didn't really understand them, maybe, and I don't think they really understood us. But I mean, there was. There's never a real problem in that, you know, we were always able to sort of accept each other's differences fairly well, I think. You know, we had the translators that go out, and the people, they just appreciate us being there. You know, we were out, it was always out on business.
And what about the training? You guys were trained for combat, but what about, I mean, here you're kind of, you know, really getting involved in civil life and helping reconstruct the country. Did you have training for that, or you had to kind of make it up as you went?
Well, it's definitely a different sort of operation, but... the fundamentals still apply. I mean, I'm surprised. I mean, the sort of our background is obviously in combat as grunts and 0311s.
What is 0311?
That's an infantry rifleman.
Okay.
So, I mean, the fundamentals still apply. I mean, clearing a house on a raid is still clearing a house, and doing a patrol is still patrol. So we're able to adapt fairly easily, I think, to the civil-type operations.
So you found that it transferred over pretty well?
Yes, yes. I mean, obviously, you go in, you know, maybe not quite as aggressive, you know, and...
Were the guys sitting around saying, you know, after, I don't know, a hard day in the sun out with crowds instead of combat, saying, this isn't what I joined the Marines for, this isn't what I trained for?
Well, you know, I mean, we go where they tell us and we accept the missions that we're given. I mean, obviously, it wasn't always the most fun thing to be doing. Can't say we're particularly enjoying ourselves, but we felt like, you know, the mission was worthwhile, you know, and the people really... seem to appreciate having us there. So, I mean, that was really a justification to keep going out there.
We're talking tonight with Corporal Zachary Johnson, U.S. Marine Corps, and Lieutenant Corporal or Lance Corporal Jeremy Villanueva, both from the 1st Marine Division, just back from 8 months in Iraq and preparation for Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. Do their stories speak to your hopes or your fears in Iraq? Is the U.S. military mission now in Iraq one that can be accomplished? Is it doable? What do you hear in these young men's, soldiers' stories? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with two U.S. Marines just back from Iraq about life inside the U.S. occupation, what they saw, what they did, what they know that you ought to know. My guests tonight are Marine Corporal Zachary Johnson and Marine Lance Corporal Jeremy Villanueva, 22 and 21 years old, just back from 8 months in and before Iraq. You can join the conversation as well. What's your question for the young men carrying out U.S. policy in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bill is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi there. It's a real pleasure to hear these young guys. I'll just briefly say that my son is recently back from Iraq also. He's with the 7th Marines and went through the invasion to Baghdad and then into occupation.
Back safe and sound?
Back safe and sound.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Here's my question. My distinct impression of the occupation is that the Marines have, by and large, been in a very peaceful situation, and that it's the Army that's getting whacked.
Because they're in a more difficult part of the country, Bill?
I'd like to hear these guys' opinion on that, and I'll take the answer offline.
Got it. Bill, thanks very much for your call. Zach Johnson, what's the word?
Well, again, that's really hard to say. I mean, we're not Army, so we didn't really get the news coming from them, and it was a different sector. So, I mean, again, I don't really feel current enough on the news to really comment on that.
But you know what the map looks like, and you know, I mean, Ricardo Sanchez, the general, top general there, is saying this is still wartime. It's tough. It's intensifying. We're being hit 15, 20, 25 times a day around the country. Is it your impression that the Army is more deeply deployed in areas of the country that are hotter? Is there some kind of, lines of demarcation that determine that?
It's hard to say. I mean, there are definitely some areas we go to where, tends to be a much more dangerous neighborhood where it's a lot more frequent for there to be attacks. But
I can see you grimacing at this question, and I wonder why.
It's awkward. It's not really. It's something that's sort of above us in a way. You know, it's not really the things we deal with. We dealt with, our small piece of the pie. So what exactly the Army had going on further north than us, I don't know if it's necessarily just different place, more hostile towns, or it's maybe some of the way they're conducting their operations.
It sounds like this caller has heard from his son, a Marine, that the Army got some tougher duty dealt to them.
Well, I can't really comment. I didn't really work much with the Army while we were over there. So I don't know if it's where they are or how they're doing business. But
as you say, you generally felt that you were 30 minutes up the road from where it was toughest, and you were grateful for that.
Well, definitely. I mean, we would occasionally go 30 minutes up the road to where it was tougher to do what we could to try and prevent the attacks happening up there, counter-ambush patrols and that sort of thing. But, the fundamental, what the underlying cause is and the discrepancy between different areas, I couldn't really tell you.
Alan's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Gentlemen, good evening.
Good evening.
I'm a veteran of the Vietnam War, 18th Engineer Brigade, 67-68. I'm not calling with a question, but simply to say this to you. You've undoubtedly noticed, since you have returned, that there's a hell of a big argument going on here about the policy. I just want to assure you that there are millions of us in this country who have taken that one step forward to defend the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that make that argument possible. And you can count on us to be behind you, because we understand morally and civically, policy and politics aside, the kind of people you are. We're damn proud of you.
Alan, we've got it, and I want to put that straight to the young men I'm sitting here right now, and thank you for your call. But let me ask each of you. I mean, you know what the history is. You know Vietnam was tough, and people came back and soldiers came back with pretty rough receptions after a while. There is a big debate going on right now. I wonder how and you hear Alan standing up to say, you go, guys, he's with you. What's your experience been since you've come home? Jeremy, what's the reception been?
Well, as a matter of fact, when I came back to California, I didn't really stay long, but I went up to Bakersfield, where I'm from, and it was pretty quiet down there. But when I came over to the East Coast, it seems like every place I've gone to, I've seen a demonstration of some sort, But
How do you feel about that?
If I fought for the freedom that they have to protest, so if they want to protest, by all means, go ahead. I mean, I fought for that, right?
We hear it. And Zachary Johnson, what's your impression coming home? Obviously, there's a debate. It's a democracy. There's a debate going on about what's happening there. How do you feel about it personally? How do you feel about it at a policy level?
I don't really know. I mean, like I said again, hate to say it again, but I'm not really current enough on the news to really want to discuss the policy. And that's not really something that I think personnel in the U.S. military should really.
Then what about your personal reception and the way you've been received home? When people hear Here's Zach Johnson. He's just back from 8 months, most of it in Iraq. What's the response you get?
It's just been an incredible amount of support, really. People have been they've all been very gracious and very kind, you know, and have really helped us feel good, mm-hmm. you know, about why we were over there. Yeah. Like, for example, as we were flying back in, we had a layover in Maine mm-hmm. for an hour and a half in mm-hmm. Bangor, Maine. Mm-hmm. And we got off the plane just to stretch our legs for an hour and a half, and there were probably over 100 people there, a lot of old veterans and whatnot, just there to welcome us back to the U.S., just total strangers, you know. So that was pretty amazing, you know, and just everywhere we go, when someone finds out that we just got back, I mean, they're always very appreciative, you know, and make us feel good about it.
And what about when you were in Iraq? Do the Marines, do the soldiers keep up with the news from the States? Do you know, are you reading Time magazine where the cover says "Mission Not Accomplished"? Is that part of your world over there, Jeremy?
Well, as a matter of fact, we'd get our hands on some Stars and Stripes and some newspapers that people back at home would send us, and you know, we really, you know, most of the time we really wouldn't, you know, keep, you know, up with what's, you know, on the front cover, because it's like, oh, you know, something else happened in Iraq. Oh, that's great. You know, I'm in Iraq right now. I don't mm-hmm. want to read about that, you know. Mm-hmm. So really what we, what me and Zach over here would usually do was we'd flip to the sports section and we'd watch, we'd look at the, you know, Red Sox and the, you know, Yankees, how they were doing.
And just do the job.
Yeah.
What's your sense, Zach, of morale in general? I mean, we got reports that, you know, after the hot war, and then it got hot, you know, literally just the temperature got very hot and people were in difficult circumstances, staying longer than they thought. Were there ups and downs over the weeks and months to morale? What was your general sense of it?
I mean, it definitely was a very frustrating time, you know, and the conditions were, you know, very uncomfortable a lot of the time. And it could be frustrating because continuing doing operations, you know, and you don't always feel like, you know, necessarily getting the results you want. Mm-hmm. But I think overall, I mean, like I said, we had a tremendous amount of support from the local people. You know, they the vast majority were very supportive of our mission, and they always let us know they'd appreciate what we're doing. I mean, just be patrolling through the streets at night, you know, and just have someone come out of a house or something and say thank you, you know, that sort mm-hmm. of thing. That really helps a lot. It helped us feel like, okay, you know, we're here and we're doing this, and weren't sure how they felt back home since we weren't so up with the news. We knew there was controversy, but I feel like doing it for the Iraqi people themselves, you know.
And what about, I mean, there clearly are U.S. soldiers running into trouble here that's not welcoming to these 15, 20, 25 attacks a day, the roadside bombs that they're up against. You're saying you didn't have so much of that right where you were, but what's the sense of that? Who's that coming from?
It's hard to say. I mean, and always, whenever you went out, I mean, everyone you look at, you can't really tell, you know, just by looking at them, if that's a friend or a foe, you know. They may love you or hate you. You know, and some may smile and wave and then secretly want to stab you in the back. So you always had to be cautious, you know, and we always took necessary precautions. But
did that get in the way of establishing relationships with Iraqis? Because you're kind of out and exposed and at the ready.
Well, our policy, the 1st Marine Division, sort of our slogan, where there was no better friend, no worse enemy. You know, we wanted the people to understand that we were there for them and we wanted to help, but also have them respect that, you know, if someone did choose to pick a fight with us, then, you know, we would accept and bring the fight to them very quickly.
Dave is calling from Antigua, Guatemala. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot. And Semper Fi, Zachary and Jeremy.
Yeah.
I'm a veteran of the Vietnam War, 1st Marine Division, Fox 27, as a matter of fact.
What's on your mind tonight, Dave?
Well, I'm just thinking. I just want to say that, you know, I'm one of the people who don't support the Bush policy in Iraq.
Okay.
And that doesn't mean I don't support my Marines. I don't support what they're doing. They're there to do a job, and they have no say in what's going on.
Mm-hmm, okay.
The other thing is, I was concerned about the position they were put in during this war. I saw one news clip on CNN where a U.S. Marine actually put his foot on a man's head, and while the other guys were pointing weapons at his family and children, and that disturbed me very much.
This is in some kind of raid. We've seen some of that.
You know, some kind of raid. I understand they're, you know, I understand they were put in the position where they were acting as policemen. I just think that is wrong. You know, the Marine Corps traditionally has been an assault force. We take property and the Army occupies it. And I just felt like that these kids, these young men, were put in a position that they had to do this to protect themselves, but I thought it was very, very, very difficult. It must have been a very difficult time for them, too, because this man was intimidated and disgraced in front of his family, you know, putting a boot on the head of a person even showing your feet in Islamic culture is contrary to everything that these folks believe in. And I just felt like these guys were put in a situation. And I just want Zach and Jeremy to know that those of us who want them to come home safely, we aren't unpatriotic. We just think that the decision to go there was probably wrong. And I'm glad that they both came back alive.
Dave, we've got it. And thanks for your call. What about that? The heart of this is Dave saying Marines are trained as an assault force, not a police force. And you may find yourself in the middle of a situation that doesn't lend itself to a kind of assault mentality, and therefore into some pretty tough situations. Did that happen in your case, Zach?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, we do consider ourselves an assault force, but we also like to think of ourselves as being very adaptable, too. Adapt and overcome is sort of a Marine Corps motto. So, I mean, we did our best, and like I said, we could still use the same fundamentals. You know, you go out and do these operations, you do these raids. We made an effort not to use, you know, more force than was necessary, but we always made sure that we took adequate precautions. You know, we made sure that we were doing what we could to provide for our own safety in those situations. So occasionally, I mean, it's not, you know, a very pretty job to do, but I think given the situation, we're just doing the best that we can and never went out of our way to actually, you know, deliberately hurt anyone or use more force than what we thought was necessary.
Did you sometimes perceive, Jeremy, that the Iraqis you had to confront were feeling not just scared, but, you know, humiliated, insulted? Did that come into your equation sometimes?
With the type of stuff that we had going, there was a number of things that, you know, a number of feelings that these, you know, people would, you know, bring forward to us. But I would have to say, Dave, if you're, you know, still listening out there in Antigua, that not once did any of my Marines that are under me, any of the Marines that were above me, did I see anyone that would dishonor them, do anything that would dishonor themselves or the Marine Corps. We were out there and we did our jobs we bent over backwards to keep the honor of the Iraqi people and of ourselves clean. Now, I don't know what the story was. I wasn't there. I didn't see the same picture that you did. But with the Marines in 1st Battalion, 4th Marines, every single one of us went out of our way for these people. We would, you know, go out there. We'd risk our lives sometimes helping these people with the transfer of power and getting rid of, you know, a dictator. And I never saw one time anybody, you know, dishonor themselves like that.
Jeremy, we hear your emotion in that. I want to ask each of you, just because you've been there and we haven't, is it going to work? Can it work? Are you optimistic?
I really hope so. I do. I am optimistic because you see, you know, the injustice and the hardship that these people suffered is, you know, really incredible. You know, I mean, you see it every day and everywhere, how tragic it was. You know, so I really, really do hope that it does work for them. You know, I think they deserve a better deal than what they got. So I'm sure it's going to be a tough job. It's definitely a very tough job while we're there. And it's very confusing to know how to proceed. But I really hope it does work. And I think it can, you know, I mean, if we stick with it.
And Jeremy, we've just got a few more seconds.
Yeah, I am very optimistic with the state of Iraq. I'm sure once, you know, everybody, because the people really want us there, once, you know, they get into the flow of things, I'm sure everything will turn out, you know, great in Iraq.
Do you want to go back?
I got 10 months. I'm going to just
10 months
happens.
And then out?
Yes.
Oh, so you're hoping not. I want to thank both of you so much for being with us tonight and bringing us that firsthand account. Jeremy Villanueva, thank you very much for being with us.
Great being here.
Zachary Johnson, thanks as well.
Well, thanks for having us.
Zachary Johnson, Corporal in the U.S. Marine Corps, just back from 8 months in Iraq, and Jeremy Villanueva, Lance Corporal, U.S. Marine Corps, 22 and 21. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.